welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at George Sluzer and his 1988 film The Vanishing and its American remake. With me here today to talk about The Vanishing is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So you made me do my homework on this. you made me read the book, you made me watch the original one from 1988, and the remake. I like two. I thought the book, of the three, the book was the best, in my opinion. I thought the original film was very good. The American remake was god-awful. It's up there, I think, with Dogville, as far as movies I've just hated so much when we had to see.
Something's finally unseated Dogville. That's good. And this should be the one because the remake is just so powerfully bad.
And what's so fascinating is it's the same director.
And the same story.
Yeah. I find that just mind-boggling. I don't know if it's the studio that said, well, you got to make it a happy ending, or we want to focus more on this love story, not have her leave him, but she has to stay with him or save him at the end.
It wasn't his idea. They told him he had to have a happy ending, that Americans would not like the original ending. So it wasn't his fault, quote unquote. Also, he had actually filmed an ending where the guy gets caught. And then he decided, you know, it just kind of ruins the buildup of what you're waiting to happen. So no one's ever seen that version.
I think the whole point of the movie is it's all playing on this, you know, two themes. One of the theme is the character of Rex, his obsession with finding out what happens. What I find interesting in the story is, you know, in the book and in the original, is that he's not out there to get revenge. He's not, you know, even though he has that anger fit, he's not out there to get revenge. He says, I don't even hate you. He just wants to know what happened. That's what's obsessing over him. He wants to know what happened to her. And he's at the point where his girlfriend left him. He has nothing really else left in his life. So even if it means he's going to be dealt the same fate as her, it'll be fine as long as he knows what happens. And that's great theme because it's not, this is an American version, but in another American movie, you could see where, you know, you killed my wife, you son of a bitch, and you're going to die, you know.
There's a scene in the car, too, though, before she disappears, where she basically tells him her fear is that he's going to leave her, and he promises he won't. So it does kind of set him up that when she does disappear, he kind of has to. And wouldn't you want to know? I mean, isn't that just a human...
Yeah,
it's human nature to want to know.
It's the itch you can't scratch. And then the other great part, the other great theme of the movie is just the bad guy, the villain. And what's interesting about him is that, you know, he's not like he's a murderer. He's not like your Hannibal Lecter or somebody where it's just so obvious it's on his face. He's just this very normal guy. And he's probably, up until he killed her, Saskia, he's probably never killed anybody else in his life. He's just a normal guy. He's, you know, he looks like he's a chemistry teacher. People like him there. He's got a wife and kids. He seems pretty well loved. He even did this heroic deed, saving a girl from drowning. And so you think he's just this normal guy, but then he just has this urge in him where after he saved that little girl, he's like, well, if I can do something good, I can do something bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he sets it up. And I think that's just really interesting. And even after now that he's closed the circle, killing Saskia and killing Rex, I don't think he's ever going to kill again. I think he's filled that hole. He's filled that urge. And now he's just going to go on and not do anything else for the rest of his life.
It's almost like an intellectual exercise. Like, could I get away with this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could. Well, I'm done with that. Moving on to the next thing. Yeah, the Hitchcock would have loved this villain.
Very ropish.
Yeah, very ropish. Mm-hmm. Because the character is very diabolical. And there's something off about him anyway. Mm-hmm. But he's not sympathetic by any means, but he does seem like, you know what always happens after some sort of tragedy, they interview the neighbors, and they're like, oh, he's the quietest guy.
Yeah.
He does pretend to have a broken arm, you know, with a cast, which is what Ted Bundy did. And that was the whole thing with Ted Bundy, was that he didn't look like a serial killer, what we think a serial killer looks like. He looked like a regular guy. In fact, maybe even a little vulnerable, so you would feel like you had nothing to fear.
Yeah, and it just, once again, that plays perfectly on this character. I mean, just, you know, you don't think anything of him. And, you know, once again, probably it's not even like, you know, whether Ted Bundy or something where they have that addiction where they just have to keep on killing and killing and killing. He's probably, in my opinion, I think he's got, once he's got, he's closed that circle with those two, he's done. He's not going to do it again.
Just, which makes it almost creepier.
Yeah.
You know?
Because he's never going to, he's probably never going to be found out.
Yeah. It's not some psychological urge that he is in the thrall of. It's just something he decides to do for no real mm-hmm. reason.
Yeah, and just, it gives you chills the way he prepares it and everything, in the book and in the movie. Because remember when I read the book first before I watched the movies, and what I thought was chilling is when, you know, they're at, when they show this in both movies, is when they're at the house and everything, and then, like, the girl screams because they're spiders, and then he says, okay, you scream, and then they gets them to do a screaming mm-hmm. contest, and you wonder, well, what was that all about? Then he talks to the neighbor, the nearest neighbor, and he was like, hey, I heard some screaming yesterday. Did you hear anything? No, and you know exactly what yep. he's trying to do.
Yes.
And I thought that was so creepy.
So, and so clever, mm-hmm. too. Yeah, it was a great way to get that across. Like, well, would anybody hear? How remote is it? Mm-hmm. They actually filmed it. They filmed one of these movies at a Boy Scout camp, by the way, which I thought was sort of an interesting twist. That was the American remake. Mm-hmm. And, but the character, the bad guy, he's so, do you expect him to prevail? You know, the way mm-hmm. they set him up, he's a character that you sort of see. Some people are onto him. Like, I love the scene where the one of his daughter's teachers comes across him when he's, you know, trying to ask, you know, direct, where's the post office? Oh, let me give you a lift. And she's like, you know, she recognizes him. Hey, let's go have a cup of coffee. Oh, I'm busy. And she says, you know, basically, if you want to pick up women,
yeah,
you're going about it all wrong. It has him dead to rights. She's not fooled for a minute what he is up to. I just thought it was an interesting scene that she tried to, hey, let's go have a cup of coffee and talk about your kids. And then when he basically turns her down, she's like, yeah, you're a total fraud.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that when she recognized him, she thinks that he was trying to kidnap women and kill them or just like pick them up? Okay.
Yeah, like you're a married man and mm-hmm. you got two kids. What's wrong with you? I mean, but it does make you realize he's not just going through life and nobody's figured him out. I mean, there are little cracks shown.
Yeah, and even like when he's practicing his technique originally, there's a lot of, he fails so many times. Everybody's, the woman's like, yeah, no, I'm fine. Just, you just go down there, just follow my directions.
Yeah.
And the one woman at the other truck stop, she gets her husband. And he goes, what did you want with my wife?
Uh-huh.
And then he's like, kind of slaps him in the face. Like, don't do this again.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing, I don't know. It almost seemed like he was sort of begging fate to stop him. And when it didn't, he figured, mm-hmm. oh, I get a free pass.
Yeah. And even just the other creepy part I remembered about when he's practicing the technique in the car. So he's imaginary, like, you know, the chloroform when he's mm-hmm. got in hand. And then he pulls that little trick with his daughter where, you know, he locks the door and just kind of,
noogies.
He gives her a noogie and everything. It's so creepy.
It is because you
know
see
what he's planning.
Yeah, you know what he's practicing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With his own kid.
Yeah. And then, once again, going back to the American remake, I love Jeff Bridges. I mean, Big Lebowski is probably my second favorite film of all time. I thought he was terrible as the villain in this movie. I thought his accent was extremely distracting. I remember I wrote down in my notes somewhere else that he sounds like a Native American trying to do an impression of Milton from Office Space. Because he says, you know, he's talking like this, and, you know, you got to get me my red stapler. And
yes.
I got to work at Initech and just like, ugh, stop.
TPS report. Yeah, he's terrible. And I loved him in Hell or High Water. He's a great actor.
Great. He's a great actor, yeah.
But he's awful in this. Mm-hmm. And you're right. The accent is phony. He's awkward. And he, as dirty as he looks, he doesn't have anywhere near the... he doesn't produce the same amount of fear in you when you're watching him.
Go ahead.
Just when you're watching the original, you think, you're really afraid of this guy. Mm-hmm. Jeff Bridges, you just think, man, I hope somebody can take him out because he doesn't really seem all that smart. But mm-hmm. you're not really afraid of him.
No, and it might just because, like I said, I've seen The Big Lebowski, I don't know how many times, a bunch of times, but maybe just because I've seen, you know, like all the other characters, he kind of always sort of plays this laid back, you know, kind of hippie guy. And so it's hard for me to imagine Jeff Bridges, you know, as a serial killer. And like there are other, you know, like Robin Williams played a good serial killer in Insomnia, but and that's good breaking type, but he couldn't break type. Jeff Bridges couldn't break type. Good enough for me in this role.
Yeah, the accent wasn't enough to make him seem different. No. Also, when they do have the scene where they're trying to kill him, it's like the Terminator. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times do you need to harm somebody before they stay down?
Yeah. And I'll fully admit to the audience, I skipped through a great deal of the American remake because it was about like halfway through the film. Like, okay, I can't sit through this. Skip, 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 skip. I skipped through like half of the movie just because I wanted to get it over with. And it's... And like in that ending, I was just like, okay, I can't take much of this. Skip it, skip it, skip it. Oh, he's still alive. Oh, let me guess, she's gonna kill him at the end. Oh, skip, skip. Oh, it's a dumb slasher ending. Okay, skip. Oh, now it's the end. It's the dinner. They're having some dumb joke about coffee. Okay, glad it's over though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that ending was bad. Yeah. That they end up writing about it. How tired is that cliche?
It's like almost ripping off Misery.
Yeah. Well, it actually borrows things from a lot of movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just the ending is the worst thing about the movie, because the whole point of the movie is that he is going to get away with it. What's so creepy about the movie is not only is he getting buried alive, but the next scene, we see the mom watering the gardens next to the two plants. We know it's buried under there, and it pans over to him, and he's giving this creepy look. And then you know he's going to get away with it, that nobody's none the wiser, that nobody's ever going to find out what it is, because also the last shot is of the paper, and he's made the perfect crime. And I think that's what's creepy. But in the American one, it's this dumb, kind of seems like a slasher movie where she beats him in the head with a shovel, and then he keeps coming back and then he finally dies, and then she rescues, you know, Kiefer Sutherland from the grave, and it's just like, ugh.
And even that scene, I mean, so Kiefer Sutherland's been buried alive, but when he crawls out, he looks perfect. No dirt, not a hair out of place. It's like, come on. I mean, even the, if you're going to do it, then, you know, be all in.
Yeah. We could talk more, we could talk all day about how bad the remake is. I think there's three main parts for me that why it's so bad. The Jeff Bridges didn't play him well at all. That's four reasons. And then the opening scene, I think, kills any suspense, because the opening scene focuses entirely on Jeff Bridges and his plants. You know exactly what he's going to do. And once Sandra Bullock in the remake goes missing, you know exactly what happened to her. It kills any suspense. So that's number two. Number three is the ending, which we talked plenty of times before. And then the fourth one is the love interest. Now, in the book and in the original one, he does move. After 3 years later, he has moved on a little bit with somebody else. In the book, he's engaged to her, but I don't think it goes that far in the original movie. But he's moving on. But the whole point of that situation is, like, she knows he's still obsessed with finding out who he is. He hasn't moved on. And eventually, she can't take it anymore, and she leaves him. Fine. This one, she leaves. They spend way too much time on it. The beginning, how they meet, I think, is ridiculous. Like, oh, this tired guy shows up really late one night at a diner I knew like 18 years ago in high school. Oh, let me take him home with me.
Uh-huh.
And let him sleep on my couch.
Yeah, that'll happen.
Yeah, I'm completely trusting that won't backfire. But you know, then they focus way too much time. Like, she's snooping around his house. She finds out he's writing this novel. And then she leaves him, but then she picks up the phone and leaves and hears the message that the guy left. So she comes back and has to save him. And it, like, that was not the point.
No, it was not the point at all. The point of the movie, and just the title, The Vanishing, it's supposed to make you wonder, you know, what about all the unexplained things? You know, sometimes people do disappear. Sometimes people do get away with it.
And I think this film was based on a true story somewhat, that the guy who wrote the novel said that he read this story about this guy whose wife went missing at this, you know, inner country rest stop area. And that's when he came with the story. So you can, like, I'm sure, like, rest stop areas, there's thousands of people going in there every day. It would be a good place to pull off a kidnapping. Not that I would ever do that, but it is a good place to do something like that. So you always wonder, whatever happened to those people that went missing at these places?
Well, the original story was about a female tourist, like you said, and they searched for two nights without finding her, and then 10 years later, the writer did some research and found that the girl had turned up alive and well. She just got on the wrong bus. So there was an ending that made sense for the story, but, you know, that was the jumping off point for him. It's like, well, what if somebody did disappear and then you didn't know where they went? Those rest stops are, you know, there's so many people going in and out of them. It would be, you're like you said, it'd be the perfect place to.
Nobody would notice.
Now, of course, we have so much more surveillance.
Yeah.
And random people taking selfies and videoing themselves. You'd never be able to do it the same way.
And even if there is some, if they do go missing, there'd be so many posters and ads everywhere on the internet and everything that somebody would pick up, like, hey, you know, when we tweet, she's here in this country or whatever.
Now, one thing I did think about the remake that was unusual is it had so many, like, before they were stars kind of thing. Like, Kiefer Sutherland before 24, wasted in this movie.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock plays the girl you only see briefly.
Yeah.
Instead of being the star.
Yeah, but that was sort of like the same year she did Speed, or was it the year
before?
Yeah,
it's like, you know, very early in in their careers. And then Nancy Travis, who did, I don't know, the Three Men and a Baby kind of movies. She did a couple of things. She's the star. Yeah, and everybody, of course, has the big hair from the 80s and everything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you were doing it today with the same actors, you know, she'd be the Saskia character. Sandra Bullock would have the bigger role. She's probably glad she didn't, though. She's probably glad she just had a small role.
I imagine that all these actors and actresses probably want nothing to do with this movie.
Now, the reason the movie, the original, works so well is that it is so terrifying to think of being buried alive. And it is so terrifying to think that what is going to happen is actually going to happen. But then, you know, the movie's over, the lights come up, and it's just a movie. I mean, nothing ever happens to anybody in real life. So I don't know why they had to change that ending.
Yeah, and just the movie was a lot more subtle. It didn't need to, like, even though he kills her, it's not like a slasher movie where, you know, like a Saw movie where, you know, her limbs are being torn off or any of that. It's just she's being buried alive, and that's it. It's not, like, the movie's not violent at all. And then you have the American movie where, you know, where they not only does he get rescued, but then, you know, there's the beating up with the shovel and he's bleeding everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you're killing, it's not subtle at all. And it's just, you're killing the whole point of it.
Also, it's an interesting example of the two movies, though, the different ways you can take the story. Because what I've done in class is show them both. Actually, I show the whole of the first movie and then portions of the second. And the question I ask is, you know, from an American standpoint, how famous of an actor do you have to be before they insist that you dig him up at the end of the movie?
Yeah, you're going to be telling me.
Because if it had just been a no-name person, I think you could have gotten away with it in the American version. Mm-hmm. It's just the idea that actors that people know and love have just been, you know, like it really happened, like we're really leaving him underground.
But like you said, this was before he got big, so it wasn't like oh, you have to save Jack Bauer. This was like, well, it's before that. But I guess maybe it's just, you know, we got to have a happy ending.
Yeah, why is that? What are we afraid of with the, by just having it end the way the Dutch version does?
I don't know. I think studios think that American audiences are stupid. But then again, you know, when something like the Emoji Movie makes a lot of money, so maybe they're right. But I think because, like, you know, in the Hays Code, you always had to, even if it wasn't a happy ending, you still had to have the bad guy get it at the end. So maybe it's just, we always want to see, you know, somebody, at justice be served at least. And we always probably want the good guy to get out. And if we don't, if that doesn't happen, then we hate the movie, I think.
But they made the movie that way, and it was well received, so I don't know why. Well, the guy didn't have a choice. They said, look, you got to dig the guy up at the end.
Yeah, but I think the reason why it was well received, it was a foreign film, and I think, you know, not a lot of people in America, the mainstream audiences, probably didn't see it, so a lot of people who were big film buffs who would see it in the festivals or whatever, and they would really like it. But if you played that, if the original was an American movie and had it like that, I think critics might like it, but audience would be like, oh, I hated that movie. The guy, he just gets away with it at the end.
Yeah, you know? But it has so much impact, where I think the American remake just sort of fizzles at the end. Oh, also, that ending, like you said, we've seen it before, like a lot of times.
Like Halloween sequels or Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Like, if you drug somebody, even if it wears off, you know, they don't usually just spring right back up. You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that happens every time in a horror movie. He's dead. He's dead. He's alive.
He's still alive, and he's stronger than ever, and he's got a brick in his hand.
Yeah. And let's see. We could talk about the novel. The novel, I'm not even sure if it's a novel. It's almost like a short story because I read it. I finished it in like less than 2 hours. It's like 115 pages, but the text is really big. So I would recommend reading it because even if you don't like it, it takes a very little time. But it's called The Golden Ed by Tim Crabb. And I think of the three, I like this the best. And the one thing is, when I read it originally, and I had no idea at the beginning who the person was that kidnapped her. The remake, it just blatantly tells you who it is. But even in the original, we see him putting on the cast, and we see it when we see her going into the rest stop area, we see him going right in with her. So even in that time, we know fairly certain on who is. It kills a little bit of the suspense. In the book, it keeps that suspense going. You don't know who it is until it gives you that from that guy's point of view, and it tells you his story. I think that's the one that works best for me. Maybe it's just because I read the book first, but I thought, you know, it was scarier reading about him being buried alive. And then him even just laughing at the absurdity of him screaming for help at the end was really unsettling. The original does it well, but I think it's more scarier in the book. Maybe it's just because I read it first before I watched it.
Well, I think that's probably the best way to do it. It makes you wonder again if they think we're not smart enough to follow a story. But it when they made the movie, to not you kind of have to show things that you would. People reading a book have more patience to get to what happened, where you have to at least provide clues in a visual medium like film, because otherwise people won't stick around to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
But I do think that dumbs it down, because I think you can give audiences more credit than that.
Yeah, because what I like to, when the thing is, they do give a little bit of a hint in the book what happens, who was the person that kidnapped her, because he's looking around, he sees, I see this person doing this person this, I see this person in a sling.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets it up, and then like you read from the guy, like, who is this guy? And he's like, oh, he talks about wearing a sling, like, it's him. And I thought that was perfect the way it builds it up. And I wish they would have done that in the original. That's my one complaint about it.
Yeah, I can't even remember how it was that I saw the movie originally. It might have even been on like a VHS tape, you know, back in the day. And I remember just being astonished by it, that it was so daring to explore this guy's mental, you know, process from his point of view without making him sympathetic, and then leaving you at the end with this feeling of, wow, they really built that up and they went there. You know, they went to that dark space.
What I like is they went to that dark area without making it extremely violent. Like, it's just burying her alive. He probably just, you know, used chloroform, knocked her out, put her in a coffin, and buried her alive. Where, you know, like other movies, you know, of a serial killer would be, you know, stabbing, and, you know, blood everywhere.
And assault.
Yeah. But nothing like that in this movie. And I think that's why it's so good, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not bloodthirsty. And it's not, he's not a misogynist who hates women, who is doing this because it fulfills some deep urge.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just an intellectual exercise, which makes it all the more chilling.
Makes very Hitchcockian.
Very Hitchcockian. He would have Hitchcock would have done it. Well, he kind of did do this movie in The Lady Vanishes.
Yeah, or even Rope.
But in The Lady Vanishes, there's a situation where somebody disappears, and then everybody says, I never saw her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or even... you know, we could talk about the theme of obsession. You know, you could say Rex is very similar to James Stewart in Vertigo. The fact that they're not being able to get over this person.
Did you read it that way, or did you feel that he felt like he couldn't rest until he knew, like he saw her through to the end? You know what I mean?
Like he felt responsible?
Yeah.
I can see that, because she made him promise that you'll never leave me alone again like that.
Yeah.
And then he says that, and then, of course, she gets kidnapped, so maybe he feels like he broke that promise.
There's also, in my mind, and tell me how you experienced it when you watched the original, I thought there was a chance that she wasn't dead and that he was going to find out what happened to her, but it wasn't going to, I didn't expect it that he buried her alive. I thought he was going to end up in the same place she was and she would be there. I didn't know if she was going to be alive or dead.
Well, when I watched the original, I knew that she got buried alive because I read the book first, but when I read the book, not knowing it, I thought that Rex killed her. That he just sort of blanked it out, because we see him moving on with this other woman. And I thought, when I was reading it before it gets to the end of that chapter, I thought, she's going to go missing too.
Uh-huh.
I thought he's been doing it for a while, but he always just blanks it out in his memory like Norman Bates.
Also, I thought it was intriguing, just from the psychology of evil, that the protagonist, the villain protagonist, was trying to figure out the worst thing you could do to somebody. Like, what would be the most horrifying thing? Mm-hmm. And then do that. You know, to actually mine your fears for the worst thing you can imagine, and then visit it upon somebody for a sport.
Yeah, he wants to do it because he wants to see if he's capable of doing it. And then once again, in the American remake, it's like, I'm worthy of my daughter's affection. Or
yeah,
something.
Awful. Yeah. Oh, cringeworthy.
Ugh. Yeah, it's a bad movie. Let's see what else. So these were both directed by George Sluzer.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't other films he's done that are big, or is this the main thing he's done?
This is the main thing that he's done. But he did do a great job in directing the first one. The guy who plays Rex, they really did lock him up in a real coffin buried under loads of sandbags, so he couldn't escape, and his death struggle looked convincing.
Wow.
And the actor who plays the villain, when he was chloroforming Saskia, he held her so tight she for real had a panic attack.
Oh, wow.
So that's why that looks so real when it's happening, because she really is freaking out.
And one person that actually really praised the film and was a big called George Sluzer to praise him for the film was Stanley Kubrick.
Yes.
And he actually said that this movie was scarier, he felt, than The Shining.
I agree. Although I didn't have Red Rum, which I think is one of the most terrifying
moments
in the film.
I would say it's not extremely terrifying until the end.
Until the end.
When you find out he's being buried, he's been buried alive. The Shining, it's scary throughout almost at the beginning, even with that, you know, he's driving with that dun, 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 dun. Yeah.
I think it's scary in a way because it doesn't even involve the supernatural. You know, we don't.
A good point.
The worst thing that can happen to you is that some nut job decides to visit upon you his worst fears.
That's a good point. I think that's what a lot of horror movies need to do, because a lot of horror movies now, it's always some ghost, evil ghost, or some evil demon or something, where humans can be pretty terrifying themselves.
Yes, or zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing like the undead to wake up a movie.
And so this was an American, you know, this is a foreign film that was classic that got remade in America, which was terrible. Other examples of like foreign films that have been remade in America, I mean, we talked one earlier about The Departed, and both are good. Another one I like to recommend, I know you're not a horror person, but have you ever, a Swedish film called Let the Right One In?
Oh, yes. And yes.
I've seen that. I like that movie. I haven't read the novel, but I love that movie. And I also really like the American version, which came out like 5-6 years ago.
I didn't see the American version.
It's pretty good. Chloe Grace Moretz is in it.
Okay.
And it's very similar. I mean, it's set in like New Mexico in like the winter, but it's also really good. Both are very good. I would recommend them.
Okay.
And then Old Boy, which I know I've seen the original, the South Korean one. It's good. And I know Spike Lee directed one like 4 years ago, and I heard it was
awful,
terrible.
Awful, awful movie. And again, why remake it in the first place? It was such a unique movie. Mm-hmm. And the reveal at the end, you know, once you've seen it, there's really no reason to watch it, you know, as a remake.
Yeah, I think it's more of just, let's make it in America so a lot of more people will see it. They're not going to see it with a bunch of South Korean actors they've never heard of. But if you put like Josh Brolin and Elizabeth Olsen and a bunch of other people in it, and it's directed by a person you know who goes to Knicks games all the time, people will go see it.
Yeah, it was, and I like that director. I think he's very talented. But I don't know why he decided to remake that movie. Yeah. And some things didn't make sense. You know, mm-hmm. when you changed it over. And when we watch Old Boy in class, when we've watched it in class, I say to them, it's before we remade it, because I thought it was unremakeable. I said, what are you going to do with the dumplings? Mm-hmm. Because it's a critical point of the movie that he eats the same dumplings all the time every day. And when he gets out, he's able to narrow down where he was staying because he tastes all the dumplings in the area. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, you can't really do that by just changing it to an American story, because
like it'll be pizza or hot dogs.
Right. Yeah.
Or
what's it going to be? Is it going to be pizza? Is it going to be, because, you know, if it's McDonald's, for example, McDonald's tastes the same everywhere. So you have to find something that is ubiquitous, but also
of that culture,
different. Yeah. You know, from place to place. It was very, very difficult to come up with something that would work.
Anything else I haven't covered that you want to bring up now?
Well, you know, there have been other movies that have done the person who vanishes to good effect. And one of them, of course, is the Lady Vanishes, but also Flight Plan.
Oh, yeah. You've told me about that.
Yeah. And in The Lady Vanishes, there's also an infinity sign that is put on a window. And then, you know, later, you know, they breathe on it to make it come back to say, look, she was here. So they borrowed from The Lady Vanishes. So I don't know if Hitchcock rolled around in his grave at that, but maybe he did.
Yeah, he probably rolled around in his grave when he saw Disturbia. But
but that's another story.
Yeah. All right, then last question I'll have is just tell us a little bit about your classes.
Well, this I have used in my World Cinema class. And this is a nice one to bring in because, you know, we try to see all the major players in world cinema. But, you know, Dutch film isn't something that is usually on the list.
Yeah, small country. Yeah.
Small country. But they do some interesting things. And I think this was a gem that came out of that.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about director George Sluzer and his 1988 classic, The Vanishing, and his 1993 remake of the same film. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Rest of us, Dave, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying you start with an idea in your head and you take a step, then a second. Soon you realize you're up to your neck in something intense, but that doesn't matter. You keep at it for the sheer pleasure of it, for the pure satisfaction it might bring you.